next case on our calendar this morning is In Re Parental Rights as to AJE, number 64166. Mr. Santos?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Anthony Santos, bar number 11265, representing appellant Sylvia Santacroce. Sylvia's daughter, Ava, is taken from her in a termination of parental rights hearing by the lower court. My objective today is to persuade this court to reverse the judgment of termination, to remand for an accelerated due process proceeding whereby Sylvia might demonstrate her need for appointed counsel, to be followed by a new termination hearing.
Let me stop you there. In the initial proceedings that give rise to this matter, did your client appear and or request counsel?
No, ma'am. As far as I understand, she did not appear and she did not request counsel.
And did she, in fact, refuse to communicate with the division?
Sir, the record indicates that, or appears to indicate, that she did not communicate with the state, but I don't know that the record is the sum and substance of everything that should be considered by this court. The record is heavily skewed in favor of the state, and in a case called Lutatia, which relied on a U.S. Supreme Court case, Lassiter, in the Matthews test.
But Lassiter didn't set out a due process right to counsel, nor did we in NDO. Would you agree with that?
Now, I believe that in Lutatia, the court had determined that while there was no absolute right, some modicum of a due process hearing ought to take place in the lower court in satisfaction of the Matthews test suggested by Lassiter.
Now, admittedly, this was a relatively short period of time from initial proceeding, that is, when the child was removed at birth, until termination approximately a year later. The fact of the matter is that numerous instances of an opportunity to be heard were provided to your client. Would you agree?
As far as the state suggests in the record that it created, to the detriment of my client, who didn't have counsel. In fact, the very reason that she
didn't appear, didn't request counsel, and there's nothing particularly complex about this case. It's a matter of following a simple case plan and moving through it and reporting back to the court.
Yes, the record suggests that Ms. Santacroce had been incarcerated at least three times for a period ranging from 3 months, from 2 months to 4 months, and that she had been hospitalized. Quite frankly, Your Honor, the record does not indicate why she didn't appear, and that is detrimental. But I believe Lutatia contemplates a situation very much like this. In Lutatia, this court indicated that while there's no absolute right to counsel, it emphasized that in many instances, including cases that involve medical, psychiatric, or other expert testimony, complex facts or evidentiary questions, or a parent, for another reason, is unable to represent herself, appointed counsel may be required to satisfy due process.
So you're relying on the second half of that?
Yes, yes. And the very fact that she wasn't present at any of these hearings would suggest, at least to me, that the lower court should have considered appointing her counsel to ensure that we did not result that the result wasn't erroneous.
Well, Dad was there and represented by counsel, right?
He was, as far as I know, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so I guess I'm looking more for a policy statement of if we were to grant the relief that you request, we would essentially be in a position where a TPR or a case plan, particularly in the case of an infant, would languish unless and until the parent decided to show up.
I think that were the court to appoint counsel, it would have been counsel's obligation and duty to attempt in every manner.
So in the absence of, and then I'll stop badgering you, in the absence of someone in the courtroom to make that request, you're suggesting then that the family division should sua sponte, in all instances, appoint counsel for a parent who doesn't appear.
Now, if a parent does appear and takes part in the process, it isn't necessarily the case that each and every indigent parent would require counsel. I'm not suggesting that we overturn Lutatia. But I would think that a client who doesn't appear at all for whatever reason, whether incarcerated or hospitalized, or perhaps not of right mind. At the time, as I understand it, she was struggling with...
Counsel, do we know any of the factors that you just articulated? Right mind, had an opportunity to provide information as to hospitalization, didn't do that, or anything else? We don't know. Why is it the obligation, why would you have the court obligated to appoint counsel if the trier of fact doesn't know?
And the trier of fact doesn't know because this woman wasn't afforded counsel. We have a massive...
Was she afforded notice?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, I don't know that.
The record seems to indicate she was made aware of the dates of the hearing and for whatever reason, chose not to be there. How do we leap that basic factor?
Your Honor, the record also reflects that she had changed addresses. Now, as the state points out, she had some duty to notify the status of the changed address, but I don't know that she knew that. Had she appointed counsel, she would have known that. There are all
sorts of... I think I have a mistaken understanding, because I thought she was appointed counsel in April 2012, early on, and she was appointed counsel and that her lack of contact caused counsel to withdraw, and then she never requested counsel again. Am I mistaken? And please explain that.
I'm not aware of any counsel that was actually appointed to her, and if I'm incorrect, I apologize. But my understanding is that she was not appointed. Now, there was another hearing, a prior hearing, and another child, a termination proceeding. And interestingly enough, she was appointed counsel in that hearing, and the state lost. The parental rights were not terminated.
But she currently has how many of the five, I guess, six children?
She has five children. Living very happily and healthily with her grandfather, maternal grandfather, and maternal aunt. At no point in time did the state bother to come and check on those kids, to check on their welfare, to see how they were being raised. The state points out that Mr. Santa Croce, the maternal grandfather, never bothered to notify the court of his interest in caring for the children. Well, quite frankly, Mr. Santa Croce had no idea that this was a parental rights termination proceeding.
It was also a maternal aunt who was... at least at some point in time being considered as a parent who declined, a foster parent, I'm sorry, who declined that assignment. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. She's living in California at the time, but has since moved to Nevada. But in any event, there happened to have been a hearing where reasonable efforts were waived in court, and a counsel for Mr. Enriquez, the father, indicated his consternation and concern with respect to the fact that Sylvia, the appellant, was not present and was not afforded counsel. There was never any notice. It was an in-court motion granted on the spot, and there wasn't any notice with respect to the waiver of reasonable efforts. Absent her presence, this turned into a termination proceeding. Now, look, I understand that this might not be the model parent. Had she been appointed counsel, perhaps the result wouldn't have been the same. But today, we're not here to assess or judge the character of this parent. We're going to determine whether or not she should have been appointed counsel. I believe that under the Lipatia standard, that second component, or the parent is not otherwise able to represent herself, is triggered, and that the appointment of counsel would have been prudent, and indeed mandatory under Lipatia, under the statute, under Lassiter, and under the Matthews test. Now, I realize that her non-presence at these hearings cuts both ways. It might suggest a wanting apathy with respect to the process. But I request this court consider the alternative. For whatever reason, whether or not she was struggling with a drug abuse and could not or was not otherwise healthy enough to go to these, whether or not she actually had notice and knew of these court hearings, it was in the right state of mind at the time to be aware of what was going on around her. I request that this court consider that alternative, and it wouldn't have hurt the court, and it would have preserved this process and perhaps even avoided this hearing had she been appointed counsel in a manner consistent with Letitia. She wasn't there. She was incapable of representing herself.
What is the rule you're proposing that we adopt, that when
a parent is inexplicably or for conflicting reasons or for whatever reason not present.
The rule
that the court should appoint counsel? I mean, what is, I don't understand the rule that you're contending for.
Your Honor, I'm suggesting the following. The state would have you believe that due process is dispensed with as long as the parent never asked for counsel. That's the end of the story. And I don't know that that's proper.
So what is the rule you want us to adopt?
I believe that a parent ought to be informed of her potential right to counsel and appointed counsel if sufficiently indigent and cannot otherwise represent herself.
But what if the parent isn't cooperating? What good would counsel do anyway?
Your Honor, that lower court ought to appoint counsel. That counsel would then endeavor to get that client noticed in terms of what's going on, apprise her of the ramifications of what's going on, and apprise her of the rights.
Let's just assume for a second that I was correct, that the counsel was appointed initially in April and wasn't cooperating with counsel, and she wasn't cooperating with counsel, and counsel withdrew because of lack of cooperation. How would that change your argument, or would it?
Your Honor, it would change my argument, to be quite frank.
Okay.
If that is the case, and she was appointed counsel in this matter, I would have a difficult time arguing before this court that the litigious standard wasn't followed.
If, in fact, the record indicated that your client had been appointed counsel and that counsel had to withdraw because of an inability to communicate with his client, if the facts were to show that, how does that affect your argument?
As I suggested, if the counsel was in fact appointed and she did not otherwise cooperate with counsel or failed to communicate with counsel, and counsel could demonstrate efforts on his or her part to communicate with the client, then it would essentially eviscerate my argument, because I believe that in those circumstances would satisfy the litigious standard.
So, counsel, your position is, irrespective of the party, the court should appoint counsel, and it's counsel's responsibility to find out what the client wants.
Yes, because counsel is the only person in that courtroom advocating for the parent. We should not leave it to the state or assume or presume that the state's position as to notice is the end all. And I'm not suggesting that in this particular case, in these particular circumstances, that the state has misrepresented itself, but the only record we have is the record carefully developed by the state with all of its expertise.
The record seems to be developed on the facts that we have an individual that didn't assert anything. That is why we're here today. And I guess the real ultimate issue is, where do you find the basis for the due process argument that the obligation exists for the state without requests to appoint counsel?
Your Honor, I'm submitting to the court that is the very essence of what Letitia contemplated when it said qualifies as a parent who for another reason is unable to represent herself.
We don't know if there in fact is another reason. We don't know.
We know she wasn't there. We know that she had no opportunity for whatever reason to defend herself.
But she didn't have an opportunity to present documentation at one of the hearings. She called and indicated she was hospitalized, and she was given an opportunity to present documentation to that effect, and she didn't do it.
Right, but she was never given an opportunity to rebut that evidence, to cross-examine. We I don't know, as I sit here today, with certainty that she didn't try or that she understood the request or the ramifications of
it. It's not really a question of whether you understand it or know it to be true. What does the record below tell us?
The record, Your Honor, if we go just by this record, my client loses. I'm suggesting that Lassiter...
Well, before you make that concession, Mr. Santos, I understood earlier in your argument, notwithstanding all the questions from my colleagues, you to say that one of your concerns here is that there was an oral motion made at a hearing in which your client wasn't present that would have waived reunification requirements. That's a pretty significant piece of this process. I think what I hear you saying is that's a point at which somebody's got to demonstrate that she had a right to comment about that. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the counsel for Mr. Enriquez was so appalled by that that he says in open court, and I quote, "Now lastly, the order I saw for the first time today, because it was not included in my paperwork, to waive reasonable efforts, what hearing Master Leeds did was throw due process out the window. I've never seen that. Doing this for 15 years, practicing off for 20, where a judge or hearing master will say, oh, I think it's a good idea. Let's just waive reasonable efforts here on our motion with nobody present in the court but you. Bad, bad precedent, bad problem, and frankly, if we're going to start that today, why have hearings in the first place?"
Okay, Mr. Santos, I think you ought to leave it there, and we'll get to Ms. Kim.
Thank you.
Could you begin by clarifying some dates for us?
Yes, Your Honor.
First of all, when did she have counsel? When did that counsel withdraw? And when was the hearing where the motion, oral motion, was made that Mr. Santos just talked about?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant was appointed counsel at the onset of the case. On April 22nd at the initial adjudication.
Was that at her request?
The court
initiated
on behalf. On April 22nd, Ms. Aviles, the counsel for appellant, was present on April 22nd. The appellant was not present. The matter was continued because representations were made by DFS that mom called that morning to say she was in the hospital. So the matter was continued till May 3rd of 2012 for her presence. That morning, again, Ms. Aviles was present. Appellant was not present. But representations were made that morning. Mom, appellant called DFS and represented that she was walking but had missed her ride and therefore she was going to be late. She never appeared on that date and in that hearing, or subsequently no additional documentation was provided regarding why she was absent. In fact, if she was hospitalized. The RMD, the report and disposition, was held on May 24th, 2012, where again appellant failed to appear without any explanation for a previous absence. And at that time, Ms. Aviles withdrew for lack of contact and communication.
Okay. And is the motion to withdraw and the reasons for it contained in her affidavit in the record?
I believe it was an oral request to withdraw for lack of contact and her absence from the previous proceedings.
And is that discussed in the transcript?
I believe that is discussed in the J file, which was submitted without objection to the court. It's
okay.
The entire J matter, including the minutes and a supplemental regarding the May 24th date was also attached regarding the transcripts of her lack of presence.
So was the motion to withdraw concluded and granted before you made the oral motion, the state made the oral motion to excuse reunification requirements?
That was on the same date, Judge, when Ms. Aviles withdrew.
And was she present, or do we know?
Ms. Aviles was present on that day. I believe
she was present during the entire hearing.
That's my understanding. Judge, your apologies. Justices.
No, that's fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to clarify the chronology here because for me it was a bit confusing.
Yes, Your Honor.
But based on what you've indicated, counsel who was granted leave to withdraw was present at the time that the court heard the oral motion to excuse reunification requirements.
It was an oral request that the district, that the court had the discretion to grant. Now, counsel argues that it must be in writing, it must be a formal motion, but nothing about 432B393, which governs reasonable efforts, mandates that anything be in writing or be formally done so. It's a statutory discretion vested with the court that if the safe or health of the subject minor is a concern for the court may, sua sponte, or upon the movement of any party present, state, agency, CASA, can do so. It's tantamount to changing the permanency goal. The guide that the statutory provides is the safe and health and well-being of the child contrary to continued reunification efforts. And the factors were present because of appellant's prior petitions, prior failure to communicate and cooperate in petition two, which ended up in her children being set in a guardianship with a maternal relative.
Counsel?
Yes.
Right there, we have kind of a collision of due process and judicial efficiency. We have counsel withdrawing. We have this oral motion. We have parental rights at issue. How was this party then notified if counsel now is withdrawing the record as the next subsequent hearing? Do we have any proof in the file as to how she would have been notified as to when the next court proceeding was to occur to give her fundamental notice?
Yes, Your Honor. The findings made by the judge on the matter below was served at the last known mailed address to the appellant. So the finding waiving reasonable efforts was sent to appellant's last known address. Moreover, in September, when appellant finally contacted the Department of Family Service,
did that notice, did it indicate what was in the notice?
Beg your pardon?
Did it indicate what was in the notice? The notice of the date and the notice as to what was going to occur at the next hearing?
It was a prior notice. It was subsequent to the finding of waiver of reasonable efforts that was granted by the court.
Did it contain any information as to this oral motion that was made at the previous hearing?
No, Your Honor. Just the finding.
So she had no notice that the plot had thickened, so to speak. There were more dire adverse consequences.
The waiver was sent and the order was sent to the appellant. Again, here's
the answer. Did the due process require that she be notified that the ante, so to speak, had gone up, that the consequences were more dire at this point?
432B393 regarding a reasonable effort doesn't mandate prior notice.
Counsel, I'm looking at a due process, not a statutory situation, but a constitutional fundamental that you have notice and opportunity on something of this. We're talking about termination of parental rights here. We're not talking about a jaywalking ticket.
Yes, Your Honor.
So isn't it fair that the party be aware of what's going to transpire at the hearing so they could, quote, adequately defend themselves, or as counsel is indicating, that they could assert that, gee, this is a complex matter, I should have an attorney?
Your Honor, had appellant appeared and participated in the case.
Well, I'm going with the facts here. She didn't appear.
Yes.
So the question is, shouldn't she have been given notice?
She was provided notice of the subsequent finding.
Was she given notice, though, as to the change?
Yes, that in fact that the waiver
the
was
oral motion.
Not prior to the oral motion, but subsequent to the finding. And in September of 2012, when appellant did contact finally the caseworker went to the jail, gave her the copy of the case plan, the waiver of reasonable effort that was granted, and discussed services. At that meeting, there was the caseworker facilitated another drug court program for mom to attend. It's all about kids. She again arranged visitation for the appellant and continued to monitor her case plan.
Counsel, can the waiver of reasonable efforts be reconsidered by the family court? And in fact, can the matter then return to what we refer to typically as the concurrent plan, where reunification but placement with the foster parent is part of it?
Absolutely. October 2nd of 2012, when appellant finally made her one and only appearance out of the seven juvenile matters. On that October 2nd, 2012 hearing, she did not request that the waiver be set aside. There was discussion of the case plan, her lack of case plan compliance, and lack of communication and contact with the child. And she failed to request that it be set aside or have any issues with the waiver to reasonable efforts.
Is it true that when a child is born drug exposed and is referred to the juvenile court initially, that without any further contact, the health of that child is at risk with respect to a request to waive reasonable efforts?
This child was born exposed to methamphetamine and amphetamine and suffered from inflamed lungs. From essentially protective custody to the termination of parental rights trial, appellant had very minimal contact with the child, 12 hours at most. Here, the child was born with ailments and suffering from exposure. Based on the prior history of appellant, this is her third petition. Six children born to her, none of them are in her care. And based on her lack of contact, lack of case plan participation, lack of appearance in court, and which was the same behavior of petition two, which again ended up in non-reunification with her other children. Mom failed to do her case plan in petition two. It resulted in the guardianship of all the then siblings with the aunt. Then Ava is born, similar to all petitions involving drug abuse. Ava is born afflicted with being exposed to methamphetamine, and mom failed to act, visit, consistently communicate with DFS, which were the same concerns of petition two, which ended up in reunification not occurring. So fast forward to Ava, sixth child born, again substance exposed, afflicted by substance abuse by mom and non-participation. By the time we get to the RMD, based on her three prior failures to appear, and this infant, this vulnerable infant needing permanency, the department was granted waiver of reasonable efforts.
Counsel, do we, I appreciate your laying this out for us, but I guess the fundamental question is an individual given a fresh look every time out of the box, so to speak, or do we just roll it over and say because she didn't appear previously, it's just done? Look at this particular case and judge this particular case on its individual merits.
Our courts give each case careful scrutiny based on the facts of each case. Our courts are concerned about permanency and safety and reunification. Reunification was the goal, and the department continued to provide services in case reunification was possible and sought ICPC with two separate ICPC with maternal relatives in order to place the child. Paternal relatives were sought, backgrounded, and requested to take placement, but the paternal relatives also declined. So a year into the case, no family has come forward, requested to even visit with this infant, limited contact with mom, non-cooperation, non-communication, no explanation as to why she's absent, not bonding with this child. Meanwhile, this infant had been placed with the same adoptive resource, essentially since removal, was bonded, thriving, and continues to thrive. Again, same lack of action by the family as well as appellate. Opportunity at any time had she come to court. Our courts do not deny requests, counsel requests. We do not.
May I interrupt you there? You mentioned that the one time she finally did show up was in October of 2012.
That's correct.
I was wondering if you could tell us what the record reveals of that particular hearing and her participation in it, please.
October 2nd, 2012 was the six-month review. The permanency report was submitted to the court about mom's case plan compliance, limited contact, the waiver of reasonable effort that was granted. When you come to court, you're provided with a copy. She's already had prior contact the month before with the caseworker who came to jail to talk with her. So the case plan or the lack of compliance thereof and where this was headed was discussed. Mm-hmm. Her preference was that the child would be placed with relatives, and we were pursuing the ICPC despite the fact the maternal relatives had not followed through with the first ICPC. We initiated a second ICPC. Now, there could only be speculation as to why appellant failed to act. But she did fail to act. There was no request for counsel. One out of seven judicial reviews in the matter below. Four hearings at the TPR, none of which she appeared in. It's the same, and I understand, Justice Douglas, you asked, do you only look at the prior acts, or do you give each case fresh perspective? Each court date, each fact, each new material fact is discussed during these reviews.
Well, if I could return you to the October 2nd hearing,
yes.
My understanding is that by that hearing, she had already withdrawn from the All About Kids program. Was that part of that record, or was it subsequent to that date that she did?
The All About Kids court's indulgence, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
By September 30th, 2013, which was prior to the October 2nd date, appellant had walked away from that program.
And did that come up in the October 2nd hearing, or do you know?
I don't believe we had that walk away at that point.
Okay. All right. Anything else you'd like to add with respect to your argument? Any questions by my colleagues?
Justices, I would only like to add that this is a case involving an infant who needed permanency and the need to bond and for familial contact and love and nurturing all of which was absent from the appellant but was provided by the adoptive resource. This adoptive resource didn't anticipate adopting. She testified at the trial that initially she was informed that this was going to be reunification or, in the alternative, an ICPC placement with a maternal aunt. Fast forward a year later when that didn't happen and she was asked if she'd be willing to adopt, she was eagerly and readily waiting to adopt. This was because the department exhausted every family member to try to two interstate compact, and after repeated absences and not case type compliance, that the adoption was then recommended.
Okay, thank you very much. The case will stand submitted. We are